This episode of Energy Matters is sponsored by Arnold Golden and Gregory.
Welcome to Energy Matters, a show about how you can save money on your utility bills, use technology wisely, and live a more sustainable lifestyle. Here's your host, veteran energy regulator and clean energy expert, Commissioner Tim Echols.
Thank you, Scott Slade. It's always great to be saving money on that power bill, using technology wisely, and living a more sustainable life.
Hello, hello, everyone. This is Volts for February 21st, 2024. Nuclear? Perhaps. I am your host, David Roberts. Nuclear power is a subject that elicits a lot of strong emotions. Anyone who has ever written about it online will now be laughing at that understatement. Depending on who you listen to, nuclear is either the key to solving climate change or an irrelevant distraction, either the best form of clean electricity available or the worst, either a savior on the verge of a renaissance or a dinosaur desperately scrabbling for a few last subsidies. To try to cut through some of this noise, I went to the top. Jigar Shah, longtime clean energy investor and expert, friend and previous guest of the pod, and head of the Department of Energy's Loan Programs Office. Shah is a solar guy at heart. He got his start founding and growing some of the earliest solar companies. But as head of the LPO, he has had a crash education in the state of the nuclear industry and what it needs to revive itself. The DOE's take on the subject can be found in its recent Pathways to Commercial Liftoff report for advanced nuclear. Long story short, the Biden administration believes that in order to hit its climate goals, the U.S. needs to double or triple its nuclear capacity by 2050. To do that, it needs to get its ballooning costs under control. How? That is one of the things I asked Shah when I talked with him. We discussed the factors responsible for nuclear's dismal recent performance, the strategies that could revive and accelerate it, new nuclear technologies, and what small modular reactors, or SMRs, actually are, and the role that nuclear will play in a decarbonized economy. Whatever your take on nuclear, I guarantee this pod will give you something to think about. All right, then, with no further ado, Jigar Shah, head of DOE's Loan Programs Office, welcome back to Volts. Have you been on before?
I think we did do one in my official position, so.
Oh, right. Yeah, it's all hazy now. It's all a blur. All the past pods are a blur to me. Well, welcome back. So we are here to talk about everyone's favorite subject, nuclear power, upon which everyone has calm and reasoned and fully empirically backed opinions. So we're just going to walk through.
I feel like, I mean, it is the easiest way to trigger people is just to say the word nuclear.
Literally, I could just tweet the word nuclear and I guarantee you I would get a dozen hostile responses like, I don't like your tone, the way you, I could just tell. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Before we even get into nuclear, let's discuss what energy nerds call clean firm generation and why we need it. I think so. A lot of Volts listeners will be familiar with this, maybe not all. So, the basic idea is we're going to build a system where wind and solar are kind of the core, the cheapest bulk producers of electricity, but they are variable. They come and go with the weather. There are gaps. So, you need to fill in the gaps. So, tell us what clean firm is and why we need it and how much we think we're going to need.
Yeah, let me back up even one more step from there. I think the way that the grid worked before and the way some people still want to operate the grid is that demand does whatever it wants. The grid transports power to that demand, and that the generation basically ramps up and down to meet the needs of air conditioning and all that stuff. So in that old school format, that was coal. And then in the 1980s, when we were all installing air conditioning, it became gas. And so we built 400, 500 gigawatts worth of gas. And now we still live with that legacy of everyone running the grid where demand does whatever it wants, transmission is limited in supply, and we still haven't even deployed the most basic grid-enhancing technologies and the things in our grid. And, you know, generation does all the work.
Right.
And so now we've decided that we're going to move to a clean energy future. And that clean energy future, as funny enough, like I'm the one defending clean firm when I like did all the solar stuff. But, you know, I think when I started, this entire solar industry globally was $1 billion a year, and now it's $1 billion a day. But because solar on a variable cost basis is so cheap today, and wind as well, we're building a lot of it. In fact, you know, probably 80% of everything we've built since 2016 has been wind or solar on the grid in terms of megawatts. And so when you think about the way the grid operates, there is a need to figure out how to balance the grid and make sure that when you have, you know, weather fluctuations, et cetera, but also just to use the transmission capacity that we have, that when the solar's not working and that excess transmission capacity is there, then these other resources come in and use it. And so there's a basic question moving forward around how do we want to operate generation? And when you think about clean firm technologies within that framework, then we do lots of modeling. So NREL Clean Futures has modeling, Princeton has modeling, Chris Clack has modeling. What it all says is that in a world where you have transmission constraints, you need higher levels of clean firm power to better utilize that transmission.
Yeah, and let's just say clean firm means carbon-free, but also available on demand for as long as you need it. As far as I know, that is the working sort of definition of clean firm, yes?
Yeah, although honestly, this on-demand thing,
oh,
as you know, hydro and geothermal can store things, but they're not as on demand as people want them to be.
Yeah. So just something that's there when solar and wind aren't.
That's right.
Right.
I think that's a better definition.
And so let's talk about that category of clean firm. Used to be pretty spare, but now there are options within this category. So we count hydro there. You can sort of ramp hydro up and down a little bit when you need it. We count now geothermal there, because geothermal is sort of always running. You can ramp that up and down when you need it. Now we count long-duration energy storage, which are, you know, as you well know, there's a few technologies starting to pop up here and there. We count fossil fuel generation with 90% plus carbon capture attached to it as clean firm. And we count nuclear as clean firm. That basically covers the waterfront. Yeah, those are our clean firm options.
Yeah, and some folks are still pining for biomass plus CCS.
Right, yes. I suppose I should include that in the list in case any ever shows up. So then I guess what I would say, you know, if I just come to you and say, look, all right, we have this category clean firm. We need a bunch of it. You got a bunch of these technologies that are, you know, racing ahead, all this exciting new development, especially long-duration energy storage, some of those, some geothermal is very exciting. There's some exciting new news coming from Fervo on Monday about that. Well,
yeah,
I guess that will already be out by the time this is released. But anyway, so there's a lot of exciting development in these other categories. And then you look at nuclear and you see like decades, basically, of industry incompetence, inability to build projects on time or on budget, everything going wildly over budget, ratepayers getting stuck with massive, massive overrun costs, just a bit of a dumpster fire. The industry looks like a dumpster fire. So what if I just say to you, well, let's just do those other clean firm options. We've been trying nuclear for decades. We're not getting any better at it. Why not just give up? Why pursue nuclear?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think the first part that we all need to agree on, which I'm not sure we all do, is that we don't actually live in a world of the trade-offs that we're presenting. So the notion that someone pursuing nuclear was going to be done as solar plus storage is just not true. Like, in general, the vast majority of case studies that I can show you is nuclear versus gas. Nobody was thinking nuclear versus solar plus storage. So if you look at Vermont Yankee and when that shut down, right? When that shut down, it was environmentalists who shut that down. And they were saying, we're going to replace this with solar plus storage. You and I both know objectively it was replaced by gas, right?
Yeah.
The same thing's true with Indian Point. When Indian Point was shut down, we were going to change it out with hydro from Hydro-Quebec coming down, you know, the Hudson River and then, like, you know, connecting it to New York City. That transmission line is not yet completed, but Indian Point shut down. So guess what filled the gas? So I just want to make sure that everyone understands that, like, when they have these straw man arguments of, like, why are we doing more CCS demonstrations when those projects in Australia was terrible and there was those great YouTube videos making fun of them? Or why are we doing nuclear? Or why are we doing enhanced geothermal? I mean, I have people, just so you know, who hate me right now for enhanced geothermal because it has something to do with hydraulic fracturing.
What? Oh, come on.
You get canceled for lots of things these days, right? And so we do these things because we believe that all tools need to be on the table to meet the president's bold, audacious goals of decarbonization by 2035. I'm not predicting for you that nuclear is going to rise to the occasion, but it is my job to say that here is what nuclear did wrong in the past. Here's how we're going to do it better this time. And we'll see if people come to the party.
Hey, Tim Eccles here for GEM Car Wraps, G-E-M Car Wraps, this fantastic group out of Brunswick that do wraps on vehicles, jet skis, golf carts. They've got it on my vehicles. So check it out, GEM Car Wraps on Facebook.
Gas South believes in the difference we can all make, like the difference in putting people first and showing that you care. For us, our difference is saving people money with our best rates and no deposit, and the difference we make in our community by taking care of our friends and neighbors and giving back 5% of our profits to help children in need. Learn more about what makes us different at GasSouth.com. Gas South. The difference is good.
Logan Booker, producer of Energy Matters, here for Better Tomorrow Solar. Imagine a world powered by sunlight. Imagine your home powered by sunlight. Better Tomorrow Solar has a passion for helping you see this for yourself. Better Tomorrow Solar can install your solar panels at no upfront cost. Build equity in your own home rather than paying the utility company. Find out more at BetterTomorrowSolar.com. That's BetterTomorrowSolar.com, and see how you can make your world better.
This episode of Energy Matters is sponsored by Arnold, Golden, and Gregory, an AmLaw 200 law firm with 180 attorneys in Atlanta and Washington, D.C. They take a business sensibility approach when advising clients. They provide industry knowledge, attention to detail, transparency, and value to help businesses and individuals achieve their definition of success. AGG subscribes to the belief not if, but how. We thank John Gornall and all the attorneys and staff at AGG for sponsoring our show.
Right. So the Biden administration's basic take on this is we need to develop as many tools as possible, basically. We need to commercialize and spin up and improve as many tools as possible, including nuclear.
And not just here in the United States, but because we have an obligation to export this technology to help everyone decarbonize around the world.
Right, right.
And there are a lot of countries that have signed MOUs and now increasingly contracts for American nuclear technology, whether it's Poland or Romania or Bulgaria. I mean, like, and the competition there is China and Russia. So does everybody want China and Russia to have an 80-year relationship with those countries, or do they want the U.S. to have an 80-year relationship with those countries? Let me take us back through time just slightly, because, you know, frankly, I've learned a lot in this job. When you think about what nuclear did wrong in the United States, and we can compare it to Korea and other places, is that we have 92 operating reactors today in this country, and no four of them are the same. So we decided that every single nuclear plant should be a snowflake. It's like the original snowflake. So we never got good at a design and made it stable. Compare that to Canada, which has the CANDU reactor, and every one of their reactors is a CANDU reactor, and they're all the same. or compare that to Korea with their 1,400 megawatt reactor, and they're all the same, right? Or even China.
Who is we in this situation? Who is the we that did this?
So that's a very interesting question. So the we is the Atomic Energy Commission before DOE was started. Hmm. You know that the Vogtle nuclear plant is the only reactor that has ever been approved by the NRC.
No kidding.
Every other reactor operating in the United States was approved during the Atomic Energy Commission, and then some of them were completed under the NRC's jurisdiction.
When did the NRC come around?
Somewhere around like Three Mile Island, so let's call it the late 70s.
Got it. So the Atomic Energy Commission approved a bunch of different designs. And this is another question. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I've always been sort of curious, like, how on earth are there 92 different ways to build a nuclear plant? Like, it's, you're just, the technology of splitting the atom doesn't seem like there are that many ways to do it. What are all these varieties? Like, what are all these differences?
Well, I'm not going to be able to give you a great answer to that because I'm just not that smart. But Katie Huff can, who runs nuclear energy. But like, what I would say is that at their core, pun intended, I guess, you have, you know, low enrichment uranium, you have high assay uranium, the HALEU that we talk about now. So that's the feedstock. You have coatings around the fuel. So now you have like TRISO fuel, which basically says that even if all the safety systems in the nuclear plant stop working, the fuel itself is coated with this ceramic that actually like expands and stops the fission process above a certain temperature. So it's like foolproof, right? So you've got some of that stuff. And then you've got ways in which you do the cooling, ways in which you, you know, so some people want to use like molten salt, for instance, like in the natrium reactor. Some folks wanted to use water.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have that. But going back to your question on the Atomic Energy Commission, the fatal flaw was that all of the reactor makers created this sort of like menu of options. And a lot of utilities thought that that meant that they should actually select different features of a menu. Like, so it's not dissimilar to getting like a car and buying it off the website and picking different options.
Yeah, right.
So the reactors weren't that different, but they were different enough that they actually needed to pay attention to what features the person made when they should have just said, like Henry Ford did,
mm-hmm.
you can have whatever you want as long as it's black and white.
So the industry bears some responsibility too for not...
Well, I mean, most of it, yeah.
Not seeing the need for standardization.
Most of it, for sure.
So then why, if it's become so clear that doing, you know, 90 first-of-a-kind program projects in a row is a disaster, why then years ago didn't the industry start saying, hey, let's standardize, or why didn't NRC, why has this been allowed to go on for so long? Why are we still doing first-of-a-kind projects decades later?
So the dynamics in the industry are like, you know, there's this like narrative, which is wholly untrue, that anti-nuclear activists killed nuclear. Like, that's just not true. What killed nuclear was that in the 1970s, you had this enormous run-up in the cost of nuclear, right? So the learning curve went away and the cost of nuclear was going up and up and up. And people were saying, this is not something that we are sustainable that we want to do. And so right around the time that they were saying, we're not going to approve any more nuclear reactors, Three Mile Island happened. Mm. And you were like, well, like, I guess we're definitely not going to like do any more nuclear reactors. So it wasn't Three Mile Island that caused it. It was the run-up in costs in the 1970s. And then you had some reactors that people had already started that they finished. So I grew up in Illinois, in Northwest Illinois, in Sterling, and there's a reactor at Byron Nuclear Power Plant. Then that turned on in 1984. And then like Watts Bar turned on years later in TVA's territory. But in general, all of that workforce, all of those engineers, all of those people who worked on building nuclear reactors went into other careers. And at this point, many of them are fully retired.
Yeah.
And so we don't have any of that. So then when it came time to build Vogtle, the National Building Trades trained 13,000 people in how to build a nuclear power plant. At any one time, I think they had 9,000 people working at that facility.
So it's a first-of-a-kind project with like beginner, first-time engineers and first-time construction people on it?
Totally. I mean, we had, you know, like all the best nuclear people we could find, and we needed, you know, 100 times more than that to build this thing. And so You ended up with a couple of big failures at Vogel. One big failure was the cost estimates were way off.
Yeah.
Right? I think it is very obvious now in hindsight that when you do a proper cost study, which they did not do, then like the numbers should have started higher than they originally said. And it wasn't malfeasance. It wasn't like anyone was trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes just because this office was a part of it. It was just stupidity. Like, you know, there should have been more cautiousness. This is not a nuclear problem. This is a can America do big things problem.
Mm.
So whether it's the big dig in Boston or whether it's like any other large project you've ever heard of, like the Second Avenue subway.
High-speed rail in California.
High-speed rail. This country lost the ability to do big things and on purpose, right? Because for 40 plus years from Ronald Reagan through Bill Clinton, and then after that, we said, you know what? We don't want to attempt big things in this country. Why don't you go to China and make it, right? And so it was our official policy to commercialize our technology in China, not to commercialize it here. You remember that my career started at BP Solar.
Yeah.
Right? We had a manufacturing facility in Frederick, Maryland. And, you know, we invented all those solar technologies. We made an active decision not to scale up manufacturing in this country in 2008 to 2012. And instead to have it happen in China, right? And so it's not surprising to me that we didn't have those skills. Now, in terms of holding people accountable, certainly Toshiba, you know, had a bankruptcy. Westinghouse then got sold and, you know, now is owned by the Canadians. And when you think about what happened to SCANA, right? I mean, they are now like that utility is no longer an independent company. Right. And so there certainly were a lot of consequences. And I think there are folks in Westinghouse that actually even saw guilty verdicts against them in court for misrepresenting things. So like there were certain people that were held accountable. But honestly, the biggest thing to hold us accountable is that the fact that we allowed ourselves to lose this fundamental skill that the American people had for decades and decades, and it atrophied to the point that Vogel occurred. And I think what the president is saying with the bipartisan infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act is we got to get that back.
Yeah, well, this is another question I think that energy people have about this, which is, okay, let's accept this story that we lost the ability to do big things. We lost the workforce. So now in order to build nuclear at scale, we not only have to build big projects that take a long time, we have to sort of rediscover our ability to build big projects and train an entirely new workforce. That just sounds big and difficult and slow at a time when we're, you know, frantically short of time. Like, why would we think that we can rebuild that entire sort of national capacity in the timescales we need?
So let's go back to the beginning of our conversation and I'll answer that question. I think the question is, what do we need? I think we need solar and wind to go faster, farther, jump higher, like scale tall buildings. So they're at whatever they are now. I think it's like 47 gigawatts or something per year. That number needs to get to 100, and then that number needs to get to 200 gigawatts a year.
Mm-hmm.
So no one is questioning the trajectory of the solar and wind industry. No one is slowing them down. No one is saying like, hey guys, like we need to make room for nuclear. No one's saying that, right?
Right.
But when you think about what's changed, in 2019, when we were having this conversation, everyone was talking about replacing plants that were being decommissioned. So we need solar and wind to replace the power coming from retiring coal plants and natural gas plants. Today, we're talking about persistent load growth that's six times higher than what we've experienced the last 20 years. And we have, you know, AI saying, I mean, Microsoft alone, I think, is saying we need 10,000 megawatts for ChatGPT.
Bitcoin.
You've got Google, Amazon, Apple, Meta. Then you have EVs, right? Which, by the way, is not as big of a problem, but we can get into that at some other podcast. And then you've got the extraordinary success of the bipartisan infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act. We have three times more manufacturing plants going up right now than our 30-year average. So all of those projects need electricity. So with all of the solar and wind that people are going to build as much as possible, we still don't have enough to double sales by 2050, which is what everyone's predicting now. And then you say, let's do geothermal. Great, let's do geothermal. When you look at geothermal, we've got 3 to 5 gigawatts of geothermal that we think is immediately stuff that we can, you know, do by 2030.
Everyone has tough times in their life. By checking the Project Share box at the bottom of your utility bill, you can make life a little easier for your neighbors. Your $1, $2, or $5 checkoff is matched by the utility and then used by the Salvation Army to help folks having a tough time paying their energy bills. It's that easy. Join PSC Commissioner Tim Echols and many others by donating via your power bills this year. See more by clicking ProjectShareInfo.com. And thank you.
Tim Echols, host of Energy Matters, here with Jeff Pratt of Green Power EMC. Jeff, more and more EMCs are offering solar to their members, and you're seeing it grow like crazy across rural Georgia.
Tim, you're right. Co-ops in Georgia are doing a great job of deploying solar across the state. In fact, they're leaders in the country with respect to engaging customers and deploying large-scale solar to benefit all their members.
Hey, contact your EMC and ask them about their solar energy policy, or just Google Green Power EMC.
You've heard about Gem Cars on Energy Matters. Made by Polaris in Anaheim, California, these street-legal, small electric vehicles go where golf carts are not allowed. Equipped with seatbelts, headlights, optional doors, and a tag, Gem Cars and Trucks are perfect for shuttles, corporate, or college campus use. In fact, Georgia Tech has over 100 of them. The new generation Gems have many options when selecting the battery type, onboard chargers, and enclosures to suit the climate. Go to GemCarService.com to find out more. That's GEMCarService.com.
Marlin Gas Services, a subsidiary of Chesapeake Utilities Corporation, is your leader in mobile pipeline solutions for hold, peak, and backup services to meet utilities' demand schedules, and their experts in CNG and RNG transportation and logistics solutions. No pipeline, no problem. Marlin Gas Services can provide uninterrupted natural gas service for short or long-term projects, no matter the location. Learn more about how we can support your mobile natural gas needs at marlingas.com/energymatters. That's marlingas.com/energymatters.
Hello, island friends. Let me tell you about Tim Echols. Mr. Tim loves Georgia and helped keep our rates low. He knows everything about energy and has led by example. I hope you listen to his radio show called Energy Matters. Join me in supporting Tim.
You've run all these numbers and done all these models, and basically the sort of position of the LPO is that we need to 2 or 3X our nuclear capacity. And the way you come to that is by sort of running the model, like how much can we get out of wind and solar? How much can we get out of geothermal, et cetera, et cetera? What's left over that we need? We need 2 to 3X.
And that's 200 gigawatts, and that's what the president announced at COP, is that we need to triple our nuclear capacity.
But that modeling presumably is based on some assumptions about the future costs of long-duration energy storage and geothermal and stuff like that.
Yes, and we can definitely have that conversation, although that rabbit hole is very deep. but I think, I mean, let's just suffice it to say that solar plus wind plus long-duration energy storage can be considered clean firm, right?
Mm-hmm.
But let us just like run a thought experiment for a second. The deciders of this are the hyperscale data centers, because they themselves need 200,000 gigawatt hours, 200 terawatt hours of new power by 2030, right? And that's the low-end estimate from Boston Consulting Group that Rob Gramlich put in that grid strategies paper that got all that press a month ago. So if you ask those people how to solve this problem, they could easily pick off a bunch of solar and wind projects sitting in transmission queues. You know that there's 2,000 gigawatts of that, right? And say, why don't we just put an 18-hour battery there and just run that sucker off-grid, right? But guess what? That number is coming in right now closer to like $200 a gigawatt hour, if that. It may be even higher.
Right.
So you know what they're choosing to do instead? They're building a bunch of bloom boxes powered by natural gas to run a lot of those off-grid. And they're not off-grid. It's like under-gridded. Like, so right. They have locations where the utility has half the power that they need. They get the other half from Bloom. And then they're waiting for the utility to catch up in 2 years when the interconnection gets full. And then, of course, the Bloom box continues to run. So I just want to make sure we're crystal clear about the fact that this is not a theoretical conversation. Like, if Microsoft and Google and Amazon and Meta and Apple thought that what you were saying was something that they could do today, they would sign a contract for it today.
Yeah, well, I mean, small, affordable nuclear is not something we can do today either. Whatever bet they make is a bet on some future radical expansion of something.
But let's test that theory. So I agree with you. nuclear has not proven itself. Let's be crystal clear about that. But if you look at Unit 3, Unit 3 came in at X dollars.
Ed Vogel.
And then Unit 4 came in at a 30% discount to Unit 3. So if you just built Unit 4 again at Unit 5 right next door to Unit 4, it would come in at somewhere in the neighborhood of $130 a megawatt hour. And you'd be able to do it in half the time.
Got it.
Because you have a trained workforce and all that stuff.
You're confident in the learning curve if we standardize our design. One more question about that, because I have a bunch of questions about the standardization thing, but just to get this off my screen, one of the stories you hear from nuclear, I probably shouldn't call them bros on the podcast, lest I tip my
hand.
Enthusiasts online is that the reason nuclear isn't flourishing today is a thicket of regulations and requirements and sort of hyperactive safety requirements and all this stuff at the NRC. And it's this regulatory tangle that they can't get through. And that's what's holding it back. You just don't buy that at all?
The headline answer to your question is that it's not true. The NRC is not in the way of nuclear today. Now, are there improvements that they can make? Yes, I'll give you an example of one. So for instance, like when you look at the modern nuclear designs, whether it's the Hitachi BWRX-300 or whether it's the Holtec or NuScale reactors, in the NRC's actual regulations, you have to have active safety systems.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we've proven—
Right, I've heard this, right, because they have passive safety systems in these
right.
new ones.
Now, should the NRC update that? Yes. But is that actually what's holding up new designs?
Right.
No.
Right.
I can give you a list of 20 things the NRC needs to improve. And in fact, we've talked to our colleagues there and they are improving them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not. That's not the long pole in the tent.
Got it. So that's a little bit of cope from the nuclear enthusiasts, as we might call it. All right. So here's my main question about this whole thing. I hear sort of two stories in nuclear. One is the story you're telling now, which is we have these big designs now, the sort of standard design now is fine if we just pick one of them and do it over and over again.
Which if we did the big one, it would be the AP1000.
Yeah, the AP1000, which is the one that is sort of, you know, kind of the default now. And then we have this other story I hear from nuclear, which is about all these new, smaller, safer, exciting technologies coming online. There's SMRs, micro reactors, there's pebble bed, this and this and
yeah.
that. So is it standardized on the old technology or is it develop these new technologies? How do we get those, how do those two stories sit in our head next to one another?
Yeah, it's a great question. I saw Jesse's tweet on, why would you do 1,200 megawatts of SMRs instead of one AP1000, right? Which is the same amount. So basically, the way nuclear works is you always want to build two or four, not one, for a variety of reasons. Some are resiliency-based, right, in terms of if something has to go down or whatever. But the other reason is because at every single site, you have certain like security costs and site costs and other things. And so you want to share that over other things. And then the last issue is that you always get a cheaper price between one and four. So the first one's always more expensive at every site. Even when we're building the 30th nuclear reactor, it'll be the same. That the new site, the first one will be more expensive, the second will be cheaper, the third one cheaper, the fourth one's cheaper. So it is objectively the case that if you went to a 1,200 megawatt coal site, which by definition only has 1,200 megawatts of infrastructure around it, and you built one AP1000, that would be more expensive than building four 300 megawatt reactors because the second, third, and fourth one will be cheaper than the first one. And so it's better to do it that way. And then you get the resiliency benefits, et cetera. So if you're going to build the AP1000, you need a minimum of 2,200 megawatts of infrastructure around that site.
That's a lot.
It's a lot.
But that doesn't totally answer my question, which is, what should we make of the hype around the new nuclear technologies? If standardization is the problem and the solution, what is the point of all these new technologies?
It's a good question. So the way this stuff works always is you have to have a customer and you have to have, you know, a constructor and all that stuff, right? So the question is, what's the forcing function, right? Obviously, from DOE's perspective, what we care about is making sure all these tools get across the bridge to bankability and all that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Great. What does the marketplace want? So in some of these states, it is viewed by many utilities that they are either going to build nuclear or they're going to build gas or hydro or geothermal if they can't, right? So this is the fight that Tyler's having online with on the Duke Energy IRP, right? Duke Energy's definitely going to build 7,000 megawatts of gas or else they're going to build nuclear. They're not going to build solar plus long-duration energy storage because for whatever reason, the people that work there believe that that is not going to meet the needs of the industrialization of North Carolina. And that includes, by the way, the regulators. So when you talk to Governor Kemp in Georgia, what he will say at Davos and in every other thing he's done over the last 6 weeks is that these manufacturers have chosen Georgia over other places. And Georgia, as you know, has been the undisputed winner out of the IRA sweepstakes.
Yeah.
Because of Vogtle, because they want to control scope 2 and scope 3 emissions, and being able to have 24/7 clean power matters. Now, we can say that that's lip service, fine.
And can't we also just say that those guys are wrong and that they are not up on the latest? Like, just because they say that doesn't, you know, like they shouldn't force us to accept that just because they think that.
Well, but I don't know who us is here, right? Remember that, like, we have moved from this industry when you and I were first doing it of being labeled alternative to now us being the energy industry. So we're talking about ourselves here, right? Like there isn't an other at this point, right? So the question now becomes, if Microsoft and Google have publicly said that they need to be 24/7 matched with clean energy by 2030, they have a set of options. They can get hydro. And you may have saw that Iron Mountain agreed to pay up to $115 a megawatt hour for hydro from Rye Development because that's what they think it'll cost to do 24/7 matching.
Interesting.
And so they have other options. They could do solar plus wind plus long duration energy storage. We've talked about a lot of this, particularly with 45V and the matching there. So folks have protocols, all these other things. They could do natural gas plus CCS at 90% that you talked about. And Google even published a paper on this, right? And their paper suggests that they believe that nuclear power is the likeliest to be able to meet this 24/7 matching requirement that they have, right? So then what they do with that data is they go to a utility and they say, we would like a hamburger today and I'll give you two hamburgers tomorrow, right? So they're saying our CFO needs a data center next week because it's dependent upon us making $20 billion a quarter in profits. So we'll do that, and in exchange, we'll agree to pay an above-market tariff for 24/7 matched clean power that you will start construction of to supply us with this 24/7 matching that we need, whether it's in 2030 or whether it's in 2035, right?
As the Southeast's leading non-utility power provider, Cherry Street Energy energizes businesses like Porsche and Gulfstream in cities like Macon and Atlanta with predictably priced, emission-free electricity. We build, own, and operate solar power plants for our partners, allowing them to deliver on sustainability promises with no complexities, upfront costs, or ongoing maintenance. All they get is a power bill, simple as sunshine. To learn more, contact us at info@cherrystreetenergy.com.
Tim Eccles of Energy Matters here for Solar Sun World. No doubt you've seen solar panels popping up all over the state. If you want the precision of German engineering when it comes to solar, Solar Sun World is for you. Gerd and all the folks at Solar Sun World understand the complexities of solar and how to make it work for you. From tax credits to inverters to accelerated depreciation, they'll advise you on the best path forward. And Solar Sun World now offers power purchase agreements. Find them at solarsunworld.com, solarsunworld.com.
Hello, Commissioner. I feel like it's very important that I occasionally let you know that I really appreciate the job that you do and your commitment to solar energy and electric vehicles. It really makes me happy, the idea of our wonderful state having more and more solar. Just, it really excites me. I really love the job you're doing. Anyway, thank you. Have a great day.
Well, what are nuclear requests to the LPO? What do they look like right now? Like, what are people asking you to help with right now, nuclear-wise?
So the active loan applications we have in now are trade secret confidential, but I'll give you categories. One is like a restart of an existing nuclear plant. You've got making nuclear fuel because we want to make sure that we're not bringing it from Russia. There's also these micro nuclear reactors that we didn't talk about yet, but we can.
Right?
So these are truly manufactured products. SMRs and AB1000s are not. These are truly manufactured products. And you've already seen some of this get into the press where, you know, the oil and gas sector are paying 35, 40, 50 cents a kilowatt hour for diesels in field to power their stuff. And they're willing to pay for, you know, micro nuclear reactors in those places to put stuff in. But also there's Caribbean islands and, you know, folks in Alaska, et cetera, that are looking for these 1 to 50 megawatt reactors that generate 50 megawatts of heat. So then that turns into like 17 megawatts of electric.
So nobody's knocking on your door saying, we want to build another AP1000 giant nuclear plant and we want you to help.
Funny enough, they are. So we have $128 billion now of 1706 loan applications in from utilities. This is reconductoring and converting a coal plant to a solar plus battery storage plant. And for the first time, three utilities have come to us and said, you know what? We were thinking about SMRs, but honestly, AP1000 seemed like a lower risk.
This is hilarious to me. The turnabout in the SMR discourse lately is remarkable to me. Let's talk about SMRs for a minute because I want to cover this. So not that long ago, there was so much hype about SMRs. SMR stands for small modular reactor. And the idea behind it, which has created all the hype, is we're going to make plants that are smaller. The parts are going to be smaller. The parts are going to be manufactured in factories. They're going to be modular. We're going to create them over and over again. So we're going to lower costs. But like, if you followed the actual development of the industry, what is being offered under that banner is not particularly small, not particularly modular, and not particularly that much cheaper than the big old plants.
But the branding is amazing. It is true that the parts are smaller. So some of the parts right now for nuclear reactors for the AP1000 can only be made in like a forge in Japan. Like that will change. And the SMRs are of a size that you can make them in the US and Canada. But the rest of what you say is true. And it is structurally more expensive to do an SMR than to do an AP1000 because by definition, everything else is just miniaturized and some of the fixed costs are still the same, whether it's security or the perimeter or refueling costs, et cetera. So it will be, it'll never be the case. Like today, for instance, with nuclear power plants being fully paid off, the variable cost there is like 3.5 cents a kilowatt hour to run those plants. If these SMRs were fully paid off, it would be, let's say, 5.5 cents to run those plants. So that part is true. But the part that I would say differently is, remember, nuclear is really a trust exercise, I think, is where this whole conversation's been going. If we had, instead of building Unit 3 and Unit 4 at Vogtle, if we had built instead for that 2,200 megawatts, 7 300-megawatt reactors, I can assure you that that 7th reactor would basically be at the same cost as that 6th reactor. And you would see a ton of people around the country building that 300-megawatt reactor because now the schedule and the price had gotten stable. Maybe not cheap, but it would have been stable and predictable.
So you could standardize on an SMR, one of these SMR designs. I mean, you could standardize on anything and drive the cost down if you just built a bunch of it, basically.
In the same way that you can do, let's say, offshore wind. So like offshore wind will never be a manufactured product that gets this like solar-like learning curve. But you will go from, you know, first of a kind to nth of a kind costs, which is maybe 50% cheaper,
right,
is great. But it's never going to be the 98% reduction in cost.
Right. So then help us distinguish SMRs, which apparently are just like rebranded, slightly smaller conventional reactors, from, say, for instance, micro reactors. What is a micro reactor? Is the technology, the actual like atom splitting technology, any different in that, or is it, have they just found a way to make it small somehow?
Yeah, it's absolutely the same. And so just to finish that last conversation, it really comes down to what fits in the existing footprint that we have, right? So if that footprint has a 1,200 megawatt footprint, you'd build four SMRs. If it had a 2,200 megawatt footprint, you'd put it in two AP1000s.
Right.
Right? So like, I think that's where that is. On the micro side, you go from 1 to 17 megawatts electric, and then you multiply it by 3 for heat. And so you're starting to see X Energy and Dow have that conversation. And in that case, Dow wants the heat, right? And nuclear is remarkably good at making heat. So it's actually the conversion of the heat to electricity where, you know, you lose a lot of the value.
Yeah, it's a, what is the phrase? It's an incredible way to boil water.
Yeah, exactly. A very expensive water boiling exercise. Rube Goldberg, I guess.
So they can make them really small then. We do know how to make them very small.
The technology is exactly the same. And in fact, you know, that's how the nuclear Navy works, right? Those are all small.
Yeah. I can't tell you how many questions I get about that. Every time I bring it up online, somebody wants to know, like, if we have these tiny little reactors powering ships in the Navy, why don't we just take those little reactors and like power a neighborhood or
power a data center
or whatever.
Yeah, fun fact, in the 1970s, Jacksonville got the authority to build a nuclear crane to basically build a bunch of nuclear boats that would just be parked at ports to power people's ports. They never built one, but that nuclear crane still exists at Jacksonville.
It's literally a crane powered by nuclear power?
No, it's a crane that's beefy enough to be able to handle a nuclear boat.
Oh, I see. But what's the answer? Why don't we use those micro reactors elsewhere? Like something that is small and firm, as we said, you know, and modular and factory producible seems like the answer to a bunch of our, seems like what we'd want.
Well, we are headed there. And so the DoD started with Project Pele, right? And so that unit is expected to be completed by the end of next year. And then you've got...
Where's that and how big is it?
I think it's 1 megawatt and it basically is able to... Their specs are, you're able to move it around, right? So they could actually, week to week, move it from place to place.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So you can imagine it's very expensive.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're paying for it. So that's happening. I'd say that if you made an order for 10 of those units now, they'd be at 17 megawatts each. They would probably generate power at like 50 cents a kilowatt hour.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you know, like you have to build a real factory and then make 100 units a year, and then it would come down the cost curve. And I think we believe that that number can be sub 10 cents a kilowatt hour once it gets to scale.
The micro reactors specifically?
The micro reactors could produce power at sub 10 cents a kilowatt hour. Now that might be 9.9 cents, but we think it's going to be sub 10 cents a kilowatt hour once you could build 100 units a year out of a factory, you know, like over time.
And is that underway? Like, where are we in that process?
So these are all names that you've heard of, whether it's like the eVinci from Westinghouse or Oklo or Radiant Nuclear or USNC.
Yeah. Are these like waiting for approvals or papers or passing tests, or are they being built? Are they being built somewhere?
So they're not being built per se. So Kairos just got through the NRC in record time. These are demonstration reactors, which means that they don't actually power something. Mm-hmm. They're just, you know, prove the concept. And then we have a platform at Idaho National Laboratory that picked three of the reactors and they're demoing there. So I think we're moving quite quickly for nuclear speed. And my sense is the first commercial reactor will be online the day before 2030. For this micro reactor. So I think it's important to note that there's huge market demand for this. And then, yes, the nuclear industry has to meet them halfway and learn how to do mega projects in this country again.
Yeah. I mean, are we rebuilding our workforce?
Well, we have 13,000 trained people now out of Vogtle.
Right.
And I hope we don't lose them all. So I'm hoping that someone builds a new reactor soon so that they all don't get other jobs somewhere else.
In geothermal, maybe?
Well, we have a lot of oil and gas workers who want to do that.
All right. Jigar, this was awesome. This was fun. This is like the 101. We could probably do a 102 and a 103 and many
Let's
more.
Let's do it.
But we'll see how much grief we take for this one, and then we can calibrate
our... Who would have known that your top five podcast was going to be a nuclear series?
Oh, my God. I know. Somebody will yell at me. It's always hard to predict, too, exactly who, but it's part of the joy of nuclear. All right. Thank you for doing this, and thank you again for all your work at LPO. It's awesome. It's a real bright spot.
Well, my pleasure. I mean, I think, as you know, we've got the world's best entrepreneurs and innovators in this country, and seeing them choose to commercialize here is a big departure from, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
A special thanks to the Advanced Power Alliance for sponsoring our show. APA promotes the development of renewable energy and advanced energy technologies to provide reliable, affordable, and infinite sources of power. The future needs energy with its More of Everything message. APA is working to be the global leader in energy by leveraging the strengths of all of our resources. APA represents a diverse cross-section of the world's leading energy developers, investors, and consumers in the wind, solar, biomass, nuclear, hydrogen, natural gas, and energy storage industries. They're making a difference for all of us. Learn more at poweralliance.org.
Energy and agriculture are major economic drivers for our rural communities. Now, more than ever, our voices need to be heard. Join us today at ruralenergyalliance.org. Our land, our energy, our future.
Having a family member or close friend in crisis is something we have all experienced. North Point Christian Counseling can help. Whether it's marriage counseling or a loved one struggling with abuse or addiction, North Point Christian Counseling has counselors in Macon, Athens, Kennesaw, and Albany to help bring healing and recovery. To find out more, call 478-973-9358 or find them online at northpointcounseling.org. That's 478-973-9358 or northpointcounseling.org.